Major Han, Reel 26.
Could you tell me what the ground was like at Kidney Ridge, particularly the ridge itself, and what effect it would have on movement or lines of sight?
I don't think, really, when you on the desert, you refer to something and it's a hill, but it's not much of a hill. It's a gentle sort of slope, and the shape of it was sort of a kidney shape. But it was a gentle sort of slope, not a high thing as we imagine in England, like a hill in England is a hill and it is high. But on the desert, if it rose about 100 feet, you know, that would be a hill. And Kidney Ridge took a long area, and I don't think it was an obstacle as such, not to any tanks or anything. It was just a higher position on a flat piece of desert.
Was the ground in that area where you were waiting to go forward stony or sandy?
Well, sandy, stony, that sort of thing.
Patchy.
Patchy, but I think mainly sort of sand. But, I think at that time, did I tell you about when the shells dropped around us and one didn't go off? I think I told you that.
I remember you saying that you were shelled. I don't think you said anything about a dud.
Oh, well, we were sitting, waiting by the wire, and the shells were dropping all around. I was sitting on the ground with my back to the rear wheel of my armoured car, reading a book. And just over about 50 yards, perhaps, was the squadron leader, Neil Speak. He was sitting in a deck chair, and he used to have his earphones on the back of them, you know, and he was reading a book. And shells began to drop, you see, and I kept looking over to him and thinking, God, why doesn't he get inside the armoured car? Because they were getting a little bit closer, you know, sort of 100 yards, 50 yards. And I was sitting there, sort of just itching, but I wasn't going to get in because I didn't want him to think, you know, I was windy at all. So he carried on reading, and suddenly there was a, you know, the howl and the whistle and a... And one dropped between him and I, about halfway near enough, you know. But it didn't go off. And I looked up, and he'd gone. He was in his own car. And within a second, I was inside mine, you see. Well, that evening, or late afternoon, we drew our own cars quite close to each other, and he shouted over me, saying, "What the hell is the matter with you? Have you gone mad?" I said, "Why?" He said, "Why did you sit out there when those shells were falling?" I said, "Because you were sitting out there and I wasn't going to get in my armour car and let you think that I was winded." He said, "Well, I was thinking the same thing." So his own mind worked.
Do you happen to know if these shells were friendly or, hostile? They were enemy shells.
They were enemy shells. Oh, yeah, we were too close, you know, to our... There was lots of stuff around at that time, you see, because we were our side of the wire, you see, and all our shells were going well over. Oh, yes, there was not the slightest doubt, as it were. I think we'd been on the air long before then, if it had been friendly.
Sounds like the Germans actually managed to get you bracketed in that position, if the shells were landing in amongst the armoured cars.
Oh, yes.
Do you think they had you under observation, or were they firing speculatively?
Well, it was the general area. It was the build-up. Oh. I mean, it wasn't just armoured cars around there. There was all sorts just waiting to go through the wire. Mm-hmm. You know, those concentrations, so all they had to do was keep shelling that whole area, because the barbed wire stretched a long way down, and the minefields, and the sappers had made the roads through, ready to go. You see, and all that had been rehearsed when we were back in near Cairo, you know, for that practicing.
You said, I think, that you had some 10 days of practicing moving through minefields at night.
And that was the layout of Alamein. Was down. That was near attack below. I think, oh, was it somewhere? Not far from Cairo, anyway. And all that had been laid out. And the paths through the minefield had all been done. And we rehearsed those sort of things the whole of the division, travelling at night, going through the minefield. So it was the same thing, but again, Alamein, you see.
How wide were the cleared passages through the minefields?
Oh, about enough to take a lorries, you know, about, would you say, about 12, 15 foot.
So one vehicle width?
Yes. And they'd have another one somewhere else, because there was no allowance made for two-way, because if that was at night, it had to be a bit tricky.
Just one-way traffic?
One-way traffic, you know, and that was going towards the enemy.
How were they marked?
There was sort of tape, and I think, I'm not sure, well, there was a little spotlight things in places. I know they were at the rehearsals, and I rather think they probably would be the same, but they were.
Would these be one-way lights, like dark lanterns?
Oh, yes, yes. Just showing the edges of the road, but only facing you.
Mm. Was the tape actually laid on the ground, or was it?
No, there were stakes.
It was on stakes.
They had these same sort of things they used to steal, things that used to just stick in the ground for the barbed wire to hang on them, that sort of thing. So they were up high enough. If they'd been on the ground, I think they'd been a bit dangerous, because they'd been probably blown up, you know, or wheels of vehicles would rip them up, and then you wouldn't know where you were.
Well, it would have been more difficult to see them, wouldn't it? Especially at night, yes, if they were on the ground.
Especially in the dust and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And also, too, on the vehicle in front of you, that had a rear light, just a pinpoint, so you could see that. Because when you went through these, that area, I mean, the amount of dust thrown up was, you know, unbelievable. You know, you could hardly see the vehicles in front anywhere, especially on some of the well-made tracks, you know, well-used tracks. I mean, the sand used to be nearly a foot deep. Of course, you get any vehicle going through it, and it's just a cloud of dust. And of course, that used to be a marker for any stukas or anything. They'd see a cloud of dust going along.
They'd know it was there.
They'd know there's a convoy there, and they'd just come down and bomb.
Nothing you could do about the dust?
No. It's just one of those things. I mean, it's used to be, you know, awful for your eyes, you know, so, and breathing it in and that sort of thing. You know, it's a wonder if anybody survived it, really. Because it was, and especially if there happened to be a wind as well, you know, even if you weren't moving, then the wind would blow the dust. Mm.
Did you know of any cases of people who had to be evacuated because they had lung trouble or respiratory trouble?
No. Actually, it's surprising. We didn't have. The only people that were evacuated, a lot of them got jaundice.
That would be through infection, wouldn't it? Not through.
I don't know how they got jaundice. Well, honestly, I thought it was rich living, but there certainly wasn't rich living. I think there was a bit of gin and that sort of thing, but I don't think there was.
Perhaps a poor diet would weaken the resistance.
A number of people had jaundice, but apart from that, I don't think there are many other casualties. I mean, most of us had desert sores and things like that, again, through the bad diet, or the wrong diet. I mean, no fresh vegetable, fruit, or things like that. And but generally speaking, nothing else. Didn't hear of anything like malaria or anything. And we hadn't started taking any precautions, apart from rolling the sleeves down. At night against malaria. It wasn't until after the Desert War that we started taking Mepocrin.
But on the whole, the desert was dry, wasn't it? Where you were, so you wouldn't have expected to encounter mosquitoes.
Well, they used to reckon Egypt was, you know, you used to get rain showers now and again, but I can't remember being pestered by them. Flies, yes, masses of flies. But not so much mosquitoes. But we still used to always make sure our sleeves were down, and we, you know, in case we were bitten by a mosquito.
So you're behind the wire, waiting to go forward, in the area around Kidney Ridge.
Yes.
Presumably you were getting a little impatient or anxious because you were having to hang about.
There's nothing we could do, and the battle went on. The tanks were forward, because that was their battle. We could do nothing, because they could see each other, and there was... I don't think the battle went so easily as was expected. I think it stayed on for so long. And the Germans were a very determined enemy anyway. And they positioned their anti-tank guns very well. So it took a long time to shift them. And so I think must have gone on for about 10 days, I think, before they finally broke through.
How did you hear about that? Did you just get the order to move forward?
We were kept in touch with Sitreps, that had come through from whatever.
Well, down the chain of command?
Yeah.
Presumably they come down then through division to you. Were you under...
Brigade. Brigade, and then they'd come down from the RHQ to squadrons, and then they'd come out.
Did you did all the men in the troop get briefed as well in the troops?
Not necessarily. The troop leader would know, and he'd probably tell me.
Yes.
And I would tell the troop generally what's happened. My crew, what's happening. If it was anything of importance.
Were the soldiers in your car and in the squadron and so on, were they interested in the bigger picture?
I think, yes. Their one aim was always been, when are we going to get to Tripoli? That was their one thing. And anything that would take them to nearer to Tripoli, that would cheer them up. And Rommel. Anything about Rommel they were interested in, because they used to think he was a great general. And I think Monty sort of put out a memo to the effect that Rommel was the enemy. He's not a god. So I'm the god. He's the enemy. Yeah. But there was a great feeling for Rommel. As a general, lots of respect the men had for him.
Did Montgomery's attempts to diminish that have a serious impact on their outlook, or not?
Well, I think it did eventually when we started to destroy the enemy. I mean, before, we'd been on the losing side every time. Rommel was doing this, he knocked us back from Knightsbridge, he knocked us back out of Tobruk, he knocked us... And so everything, Rommel was a man. It wasn't until we, in the Rag of Wadi, when they had that first push before Alamein, it was our first sort of victory. And then Alamein was another victory. And as we went on, we were doing the attacking, and then it gradually got so he wasn't invincible. But before, it did appear that he was invincible.
So it was really the events and not Montgomery's propaganda that did the trick.
I think as the events that sort of swung it. But they still had a lot of respect for him, even so. I'm just trying to think where we are now.
I think you're about to go forward because the battle's finally moving.
The battle went on for quite a number of days, as I said, and we were inactive, itching to go, but we were suffering bomb attacks and shelling there, but could do nothing about it because we had to stay where we were. We couldn't sort of move off to another place because there wasn't room. The guns were behind us, 25 pounders, and the mediums, which were still continuing the shell, So there you were, just waiting for something to happen. Yes, as I just told you about the showing with this one leader.
The test of nerve. The test of nerve.
I mean, I think there's a lot of that sort of thing where people wouldn't just give in to thing, which sometimes is a bit silly, and but if you've got away with it, it's all right. But, oh, and we had fighter bombers came down onto us. We had one casualty. A troop of Warlow in Scotland was got leg wounds. There were quite a number of tanks lost on both sides over, I think, a 10-day period when we were waiting to go forward. And to the north of where the squadron was, or B squadron, there was a German strong point, and that couldn't be neutralised, apparently, and that used to fire at us. It was called Thompson's Post.
Do you know why it was given that name?
I don't know why, but it's, I think if you read up, you'll find it mentioned. Oh. And that was always, you know, quite a lot of gunfire coming from that area. And I know in that particular, from that particular place, there was, I was standing with Jock Main was on my right. He was he had been my driver, and he was Matt Abraham's driver at the time, and he was a Glaswegian, you know, a great chap he really was, a bald head, a good mechanic, you know, and he used to tell me stories about being one of the Billy Boys in Glasgow and that, a bit of a romancer I think, but he was a nice man. And on my left was a trooper Hansen. He was one of the gunners. One of the troop gunners, and they were either side of me, and somebody was taking a photo of us, and suddenly a shell from Thompson's Post exploded just near us, and Jock Main lost his arm, and Trooper Hansen got a load of shrapnel in his groin, and I was there untouched. And stay. And that was from Thompson's Post, because we had to fix up Jock and Hansen and get them evacuated. And that was before we'd even got into them.
How far away was this post?
Oh, quite a few miles, I think. I can't say exactly. If I had a map, I'd be able to say, well, that was there, that was there. And we knew where it was, or the direction it was, and I think that was a rise in the ground somewhere, but that was a thorn in the side.
What sort of scale of post was it? Do you know what sort of strength?
No idea.
Forces
were
there.
Anything about it apart from that's Thompson's Post, where the shells were coming from. That used to be the just a name of somewhere where. I don't know what shells they were being fired at all. Probably 50 millimetre, perhaps, or probably heavier.
Do you know if it was fortified with concrete or whether it was just
no idea at all. It could have been. I think it probably was a fortified post because it was part of the defences that Rommel had facing Alamein.
Yes.
And they had massive trenches and, you know, so. That, I think, must have been a fortified area, well dug in gun sites, I should imagine. I think they probably did try to eliminate it, you know, with bombers and things like that.
And artillery.
Just after then, there was a fierce battle on the night of the 1st, 2nd November, So that gives you an idea of how long we were there from the time the barrage opened up, that we were waiting. And then that's when we were allowed to push forward in front of the 1st Armoured Division.
Presumably you must have gone through it in order to get ahead of it. Did you notice lots of...
Yeah, we had to pass through in order to then advance. Of course, then we were... That's when we started meeting up with the anti-tank fire. And there was minefields still around to contend with. So we had to be very careful where we went. It wasn't a case of whips out and just go. No. Not to start with, anyway.
How many days did that last, this advance with caution?
I think about 4 days. Around about 4 days. I'll know that I've got that written down, the actual day. I know Matt Abraham, he went off with his troop and he met up with the enemy at a strong point and anti-tank guns, and I think he took about 70 prisoners that day, as an infantry and whatnot, and he also released a number of British prisoners that had been taken just around about that time. So that was quite a good thing. And then Rommel had another counterattack, but he was beaten back, and there was quite heavy losses on both sides. But I think that was probably his last fling in order to, before he started to go back. That was the end of the battle, the end of Alamein, as far as Rommel was concerned, I think.
Well, he was trying to break contact, was he?
Well, I think counterattack, whether he thought he might sort of hold his positions, but I think having found he couldn't, then he could then withdraw.
What happened to you in this phase? Were you just going forward?
We were just doing whatever we could. There was nothing much we could do at that stage. Still, while there was tank battle going on, you had to wait until that sort of finished and sort of sometimes get some of the old shots coming over. From the actual battle. But those, apart from Matt going out and attacking a strong point and getting the prisoners, there was nothing much else that was being done. And by then, I told you earlier on about the tracks that people were using. By then, they're about a foot deep in sand, so if you can imagine the dust and the was being thrown up by then. There wasn't just one tank, there were hundreds of tanks. I mean, the amount, we've never seen so many, I don't think. On this particular track, that was about about the 2nd of November. I was going along this track, and there was a column of 25 pounders using the track as well, being pulled by the quads, and of course you imagine the dust being thrown up, and of course that attracted the Stukas, and I know while we were on it and all the quads and that, and it was really, they were fairly close together too. The space you contracted into a small area, and therefore you
bunched up
a bit. And down came the Stukas, And the trouble is, when you were on the track, you were stuck there. Normally, if you saw scoopers coming down, you would spread out, but you couldn't because the minefields were around, so you were stuck on this track. And they had quite a field day. They got quite a number of the quads and the guns. And I say they came down, and it was not only with the exploding bombs and the smoke coming up, the dust that had been thrown up, and you could see hardly anything to help anybody anyway. But by the time the dust settled, it looked pretty horrible to look at anyway. There were dead and wounded laying in the track, in their trucks and on the track. And apart from that, lots of guns and vehicles were destroyed. Mm-hmm. And that evening I had to go off to collect Colonel Kidston, who had been in hospital for about 6 weeks. I can't think where I had to go to collect him, actually.
What had been the matter with him?
I know he might have had jaundice or something like that. I know he'd been back sick, and he came back to assume command. He was in hospital, on the approach to Alamein, and for the first fortnight, I suppose. But anyway, I took him back to RHQ, and he assumed command. And on the night of 3rd or 4th November, in that Aqua region, Aqua, A-Q-U-A-O-I-R, I've got it down as exactly where there was a successful attack by an infantry division, and that opened up a large gap through which the 1st Armoured Division could break out. And then we were out into the open desert. And that would be about the 3rd, 4th of November. And by then we knew that the enemy were defeated and they were withdrawing. But he still left a load of anti-tank guns, as a screen as he was going back. So we couldn't... But the Desert Air Force was having a good day. They were harassing him and inflicting lots of damage.
Was there anything you could do to actually defeat and get through a screen of anti-tank guns?
Well, if you've got space to manoeuvre, you might find a space round. And once you've got round the back, then they would force them to withdraw. It's a matter of manoeuvre. Mm-hmm. And if you could, or eventually, if you had some tanks with you or something, they could then probably destroy them. Or if you had an artillery officer with you, an OP, he could then bring his guns to bear on it, and then eventually they would go. I think there's weight and numbers eventually that would force them to withdraw. And obviously their orders were to delay as much as possible, and then get out, but ready for the next phase. There's no good them staying there to fight to the last man, because they then wouldn't be available for the next stopgap, which was common sense, really, isn't it?
Yes, they wouldn't want to lose them.
No, so they would fight until they thought, right, now time to get out and go.
But if you were on your own, just the armoured cars, and they were... properly posted.
Yes, there's nothing much that, unless they were being, we were supported by something, they could hold us up for, because our guns wouldn't reach them anyway.
So you'd need dead ground, wouldn't you, to get through them or approach them.
But if they were sighted properly and they had the numbers, but if they were thin on the ground, then you could get round them and probably... once they knew you were around the back, they'd want to get out of it.
What sort of anti-tank guns were these? Were they 88s or were they smaller calibre, as far as you could tell?